Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Dr. David Schiffman. Dr. David Schiffman is an interdisciplinary marine conservation biologist who studies the ecology and conservation of threatened sharks. An award-winning public science educator, Dr. Schiffman has trained over 550 scientists on five continents how to speak to non-experts about their area of expertise. His writings have appeared in the Washington Post, Scientific American, Gizmodo, in a monthly column in Scuba Diving Magazine. He is one of the most followed scientists on social media in the world and invites you to follow him on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Why Sharks Matter, where he's always happy to answer any questions anyone has about sharks. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
You've actually been on my list of people that I want to interview on the podcast, so I was really great.
Glad we could make it work.
Yeah, I was really excited when you volunteered, and one of the other hosts, Julie, was kind of jealous that I get to interview you, and she didn't. So, thank you for agreeing to be on the show.
Happy to be here.
Now, we mentioned in your bio that your handle on social media is Why Sharks Matter. So, why do sharks matter to you?
Well, I frame it that way in terms of public education about shark conservation, because many species of sharks are threatened with extinction. And when you say that to so-called regular people, when I give my public talks to non-experts, and I say many sharks are threatened with extinction, some people say, good, what can we do to get all sharks threatened with extinction? So I try to frame some of my outreach in terms of why sharks are important to humans as well as important to just the environment. And it turns out predators are often very important to a healthy functioning ecosystem. And when you lose the top of the food chain, it can cause ripple effects throughout the whole food chain. And sharks are often found at the top of the food chain. So sharks are important because they help keep the ocean's ecosystems in balance. And when you lose them, it can cause all sorts of bad effects for a food chain that provides billions of humans with food. So, but also, I've just always loved sharks. I've always been really interested in them. And yeah, I'm living my childhood dream.
All right. Many people in this field might have the opinion that sharks already receive enough attention. They have a whole week of television on Discovery Channel, after all. And along those lines, marine biology in general receives a lot of attention. Why is a continued voice about sharks and other marine life important?
Well, because many ocean animals are in trouble, including but not limited to sharks. And I would say if they're still in trouble and we haven't gotten the policy solutions enacted to protect them, they still need more help. That doesn't mean that other things don't also need help and attention. But this is sharks are in many cases disproportionately ecologically important to how many of them there are. And they represent a disproportionate amount of evolutionary distinctiveness. There's something called the Edge of Extinction Project, which tracks EDGE is an acronym that stands for evolutionarily distinct, globally endangered. And an EDGE species is one that the argument goes, if it were to go extinct because there's nothing remotely closely related to it, it's worse than if something that has many close cousins were to go extinct. And there are lots of sharks that are EDGE species. So lots of things need attention for sure. But the ocean is a really, really, really important habitat. And really, really, really important ecosystem for humans and healthy functioning human civilization. And it's in big trouble. So it needs all the help it can get, which doesn't mean that other things don't need help.
Yeah, so let's go back to your social media handle, Why Sharks Matter. Was that your, I guess, how did I word that question?
So it's actually based on the title of a book that I've had in my head for about 11 years now that I'm now officially writing. That will be through Johns Hopkins University Press coming out sometime next year, but a case for why we should protect sharks and how we can, meant for a popular science non-expert audience. A lot of people think of sharks primarily as a threat, that sharks are bad and sharks are scary. If I dip my toe in the bathtub, a shark's gonna eat my whole family. And really, that's not the case. And also, sharks are really important to a healthy functioning ecosystem. So. It's that sort of a two-pronged outreach strategy of everything you know is wrong and the stuff you haven't heard is really important.
And was this your original moniker on social media, or did you switch to it after finding a niche? Or
Nope. This has been me on Twitter and as a blogger for Southern Fried Science for 11 years now.
So you were able to get that because you're kind of early to the Twitter game and.
Yep. And wherever there's a new social media platform, I always sign up for Why Sharks Matter on it, just in case it's the next big thing. Is literally that. So I spend a lot of time on social media analytics, both for my outreach as well as for several research projects. And literally the day before Snapchat sold for, I think it was $18 billion, I said something like, this is stupid. No one wants this. This is going to go bankrupt. And the next day it sold for $18 billion. So that convinced me, I don't really know what the next big thing is going to be. So whenever there's a new thing, I try it in case it becomes the next big thing, because I apparently can't tell.
So is there a Why Sharks Matter TikTok?
It is not in use, but there is one reserved.
You mentioned that you have an account on multiple social media, and you follow it pretty closely. When did you first realize that you had a knack for social media outreach, and when did you start teaching others the skills you've learned?
So let me back up slightly before that and then get into that. That this idea that talking to the public about science is important. I'm lucky that in my world of shark ecology and ocean conservation, that's not a particularly controversial idea. I have friends that are physicists that they get screamed at by their deans when they say, oh, I went and spoke in a school today about why you should become a scientist. And they say, you should have been in the lab. That's not what we pay you for. I don't need to worry about that. My world has already accepted the value of this, leaving the ivory tower and doing outreach. But I was one of the first to do this, and certainly the first to do it on this big a scale for sharks on social media. And this social media was pitched to me as this idea to take my knack for explaining science to the public and my ability being good at Twitter. It often requires being quick, that come up with a funny comment quickly, to respond to questions quickly. I've always been good at that from video games. And this was sort of the perfect storm. And it was pitched to me in 2008 by one of my good friends. He said, I just went to this conference called Science Online, and it's all about how scientists can use social media to talk to the public about science. And it's happening again next year, and you should come. And if you don't like it, I'll reimburse you for the conference. And I loved it, ended up sort of being on the advisory board, and the Science Online team. Science Online main organization has since disbanded, but it lives on in a group called Oceans Online that I run. So 2008 was when this was first pitched to me, and by 2009 I was doing it a lot.
During this COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of students or professionals might have just created Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, mm-hmm. or TikTok, or they might have had more time to actually start playing with it and be more using it more. Mm-hmm. Could you share some tips to some of these people that might be trying out for the first time on how they can use it as an outreach tool for their field?
Absolutely. And we are indeed seeing a lot of that. And I should note that the training, the professional development training that I do for this, I can do remotely if people are interested for their lab or their department or their center or whatever. But I'll tell you some of the common mistakes I see when scientists first start doing this. One of the most common mistakes I see is not having a plan. Social media is an incredibly powerful tool in service to a well-thought-out communication strategy. But social media is not inherently a communication strategy on its own. If people go out there and say, I'm going to tweet a lot and that's going to change the world about science, no, it's not. But if you say, I am really concerned about public misunderstanding of this particular issue that's within my area of expertise, and I know that pushing on this inflection point, nudging here, twisting here, I can make a difference. Doing that works, but it requires some strategy. Another thing that I see people make mistakes with is they just try to do exactly the same thing as someone they know on Twitter does. And you can do that and it might work. Maybe it worked great for that other person and you're finding it's not working great for you. That's because people have different strengths. They have different goals. They have different abilities. Some of the stuff that I do is more confrontational than some of my colleagues prefer. Some of the stuff that I do is more sarcastic than some of my colleagues prefer. And if you try to emulate that and that's not your natural personality, it's not going to work and you're going to be miserable. Another thing that I see people mess up a lot is not knowing when to break away from a discussion. As scientists, as experts, as educators, it's very tempting for us to get the last word in. We really want to hear someone say, you know what? I was wrong. You were right. I'm sorry. That does not happen. I see scientists waste all day arguing with a random person with two followers about some basic fact of science that we know to be true and is not controversial at all. And at the end of the day, they're angry and frustrated and they've wasted a whole afternoon and that person has not changed their mind. So you have to be careful, because the flip side of that is recent events in the political arena have shown us that it is bad for society to let demonstrably false information stand unchallenged in the public space or in the public square. So what I do is I respond once to wrong information, forcefully but politely. No, that's wrong. Here's what the right information is. I'm not going to argue with that person, but I'm making sure that the correct information is injected into these information pathways. So that's some of the biggest things that I see. Another thing is people seem to think that you can absolutely do this. You can have a data-driven strategy with this. You can get all kinds of detailed analytics on your tweets or Facebook posts of who's seeing them, when are they seeing them, where are the people based. Are they more male or more female? Are they more international, more in the US? Are they in your local community? Are they all over the place? All of that's free and people don't use it. And depending on what your goal is, that can be very, very helpful information. So that was a very long answer, but those are some of the basic things that if everyone did those, then probably half of my panic phone calls of, oh my God, something messed up, we need your help, would disappear.
A lot of that rang true with some of the things I see on our agency's Facebook page, is the comments and messages that we receive. So
your
social media prowess and following has earned you verified accounts on both Facebook and Twitter. And but with that notoriety, I'm sure there also comes some flack. And you kind of addressed how you address wrong information. But how do you deal with, as the kids say, the haters?
Yeah. So it's important to know that there's a difference between someone who is wrong and someone who is causing harm to be mischievous. And someone who is wrong might be able to be nudged and convinced of that something's an issue and maybe they misunderstood it, and that's why they were upset with you. But there are also people out there that are intentionally spreading misinformation and disinformation, or intentionally just setting out to harass and threaten scientists and make them scared or sad. And those people I just block. You owe no one the ability to follow you. If someone is being a jerk, you can just disengage with them. And these tools make it really easy, so you never have to hear from them again. But yeah, absolutely, I get all sorts of craziness. I've had to block thousands of people over the years. I get death threats. I've had people call my boss's boss. And fortunately, everyone at my institutions knows who I am and what I do, and I have warned them that crazy people will sometimes bother you, and give me the chance to explain before you get mad at what they say I did. It helps to have a thick skin. Another thing I teach in my professional development training stuff is if you are the sort of person that you have 1,000 trusted, respected friends and colleagues who say you're awesome, and one random person who says you suck, and that makes you think you suck, don't do this, because there will always be someone saying you suck. And sometimes it's just to make you upset. They don't even know what you did or whether or not you suck.
I won't ask you to share any of those stories of the hate or negative comments you've received, but could you maybe share maybe one of the strangest questions or thoughts that somebody has come after you with on social media?
Oh man, we've had some fun ones over the years. There's also a difference between that. Something else I've had to learn with this is the sort of person who spreads conspiracy theories and attacks scientists on the internet is possibly someone who has mental health issues. So I can't push back too hard, because there's the expression punching up and punching down. Even if they're attacking me, this is someone who's not well, and me being a jerk to them, even if they were a jerk first, may cause harm to them. And I don't want to be that person. But I think my favorite one, my favorite angry misunderstanding that's ever happened was, it just popped up on my Facebook on this day memories a couple days ago. It was 8 years ago. My PhD lab at the University of Miami won a community engagement grant from Wells Fargo. And this was money explicitly for us to go into inner city Miami Title I schools and talk to them about marine science and then bring some of the students out on the shark research vessel with us. An amazing opportunity for those kids who don't get enough opportunities. So we were very excited to get this grant from Wells Fargo that they're all about reinvesting in our community and whatever. And I shared this and someone on Twitter went berserk on me and they interpreted we got a grant from Wells Fargo somehow as we were illegally selling sharks to a bank. And they never, we attempts to follow up and say like, hey, wait, what? Can you clarify what you mean here? I think there's some misunderstanding. No, this person was not interested in hearing it. They were furious at me. I was an international criminal now because we were selling sharks to a bank and whatever the shark or the bank did with those sharks was on my shoulders and all the deaths were my fault. It was really weird. But I get a lot of very strange interactions. A weird thing that happens that what may some of your listeners may be more sympathetic to than that, because that's so random and only happens to me, it seems like, is I get a lot of, I'm a postdoc right now. I don't have a lab. I don't have a tenure track faculty position. I'm very happy with the sort of work I'm doing, but I don't have a lab, which means the 100 plus people a year that email me asking to be graduate students in my lab are just out of luck. There's no lab to admit them into. And some of the things that people ask of me are just bananas. And I've had to get to the point where I just can't even really respond to all of them because there's not enough hours in the day. But I feel bad because these are people who need help and they think it needs some sort of professional advice. And I am just not the person that they think I am.
Earlier in your answer, you mentioned traveling to those schools in Miami, and you also make yourself available to Skype into classrooms or visit classrooms to talk about marine science.
Yes.
And that's a large tool in your toolbox. From my experience, kids usually have a question or story for everything. So along the lines of the social media, what is the strangest question you've ever been asked by a school group?
Oh, wow. So during this pandemic quarantine shutdown, whatever you call it, I've made myself available to any teacher who's still meeting virtually with their class, and I can just hop on the call. And I've spoken to kids in all 50 states. I've spoken to about 2,500 kids in the last 2 months doing this, it's been really awesome. And what I love about doing these Ask Me Anything sessions or question and answer sessions or public docs is I do a lot of them. I've done an Ask Me Anything session every week for the last 5 or 6 years. And every single time I do it, I get asked a question I've never been asked before. And some of them are strange questions, but some of them are just really interesting questions of the kind that you wouldn't have had to think of before. So it makes me a more nimble science teacher to be able to do these. But I get so many questions about Megalodon, which is the prehistoric, definitely extinct shark that if you've ever been at an aquarium or science museum and see those giant shark jaws, you can stand in and take a picture. That's Megalodon. There was a Jason Statham movie about them a couple years ago. But people, there's this really strange internet conspiracy theory that started with Shark Week saying that Megalodon is not extinct, it's just hiding. And scientists and the government know that and are lying to you. And I have spoken to hundreds of classrooms since that documentary came out on Shark Week, and I can't remember the last time I wasn't asked about it. It's bad. People at NOAA got death threats because of this, because of a documentary that was entirely made up and fictional that aired on an educational channel without any kind of briefing. But yeah, there's this widespread belief that there's a 50-foot-long whale-eating great white shark relative that's swimming around the east coast of the United States and that we're lying to you about this. I get asked about that all the time, and I don't get it. It's weird. But you also, yeah, you can't get too frustrated with these kids because, like, it might be the 500th time I've heard that question in May 2020, But this is the kid's first time to ask a question of a scientist. And that's the question he's asking. So if I get mad at him for asking a question that frustrates me, then I'm the jerk. So being calm and patient is a really important skill set with all this as well.
Fortunately, I haven't had kids ask any sort of conspiracy theories questions like that to me. But we do get, it's kind of akin to in the Midwest, our agencies are accused of stalking mountain lions. And
yes, yes. And
with the black helicopters.
Why would we be doing these things? Yeah, I don't understand the why of this conspiracy.
How long have you been doing these school programs like this?
So I've been doing them in person for a decade or more. And every once in a while I'm approached, hey, can you do a virtual chat with us? That was maybe once or twice a month before all this. But since the pandemic started and all the schools are closed and parents are going crazy and teachers are going crazy, looking for something to do and looking for a change of pace, I've made myself available. And that started, I guess, mid-March. And I've talked to at least one school every day since then. And I'm going to continue it in the future, though schools seem to be closing soon. There are still summer clubs and virtual science camps and things like that I'll be talking to, but that'll probably slow down some.
Since you've been doing it for about 10 years, have you had any students from those earlier years that have been inspired and become gone into marine biology, or have they contacted you about that?
Yeah, some actually became, some of the kids that we spoke to in various schools in Miami went on to go to the University of Miami and then became undergraduate interns in the lab. So that was really neat. And they had said, yeah, we got to hear from someone, we got to hear you give a talk, and now it inspired us to go to school here and study the ocean. So that's, and I also used to teach at, when I was in middle school and high school, I went to marine biology camp, like all the cool kids did, and then I later worked there for a couple years, and several of my former students from there have gone on to graduate school in the marine sciences in the years since, which has been really rewarding.
And with these school groups, especially some of these Zoom ones, I imagine are younger kids. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that you've been asked quite a bit if you know the song Baby Shark. Do you know all the words?
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about this song. You've found one of my trigger phrases. So Baby Shark is not a new song. It's 104 years old. I sang it at camp growing up, and that's before I went to marine biology camp. This was just at Jewish day camp in Pittsburgh. We sang this song 35 years ago. I moved to Washington, D.C. right when the Nationals were starting their really good, their World Series winning season, and they, one of the players' walk-up music is Baby Shark, so whenever he would walk up, the whole stadium would do the Baby Shark dance. So yes, I know it very well. I like it a great deal, but it's not new. And I actually got to do an interview about whether or not it's scientifically accurate, one of the more goofy interviews I've ever done. And sometimes when I talk to the popular press, I play it really, really loose and silly, and they know that I'm joking around. But this one, I talked with the journalist, and they said it would be funnier if I played it super straight, like I was actually upset and used big jargony words. And the end result was really funny. But basically, in the dance, you do Baby Shark, do do do, Mommy Shark, do do do, Daddy Shark, and so on. And you're making gestures with your hands signifying how big the bite is. Well, Grandma Shark would have the biggest bite, and Mommy Shark would have a bigger bite than Daddy Shark. So the song is wrong. And this is because in many species of sharks, the females are larger, and sharks continue growing their whole lives. So the biggest gape size would be the grandma shark.
If people want to find that interview, where would they be able to find that one if they want to?
I think it was on Quartz. I can look that up and send it to you. But it's all of my interviews and or my favorite ones anyway are on my website on the In the News tab. That's another way that I do outreach is through talking to the press, and I've done about 250 interviews. This Megalodon special that I was talking about earlier, that was my first national TV interview, and that was on CNN with Jake Tapper. And we had to restart the interview 7 times because apparently you're not allowed to say the F word on CNN even if you're really mad at wrong information on Shark Week. Fortunately, it was not a live interview.
Well, David, it was a pleasure hearing about all your outreach, but now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions.
Okay.
And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show, and we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Yeah. So my favorite fish is the sandbar shark, and if you follow hashtag best shark on Twitter and Instagram, you will find years of me talking about how much I love these guys. And you will also find years of other scientists yelling at me for picking what they perceive to be a boring shark as the hashtag best shark. Sandbar sharks are also on my business cards. They're my official corporate logo. And you can also get any image you want on a corporate credit card now. So my corporate credit card for my science consultancy is a drawing of a sandbar shark. Love them. Hashtag best shark.
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Ooh, that's a good question. I have gotten to do a lot of really cool things. I've been really fortunate. But one of the things that I really love about my job, especially during my PhD when the lab was so focused on outreach, was we got to take a lot of people out on the boat and interact with sharks. And for many of them, it was the first time they've ever seen a shark, which is extra cool to get to be a part of that. And I was somebody's make-a-wish. That it was a sick child, and that when he was hooked up to machines in the hospital, his mom would read him tweets that I'd been writing and read him articles that I had shared. And his make-a-wish was, I want to go see sharks with Why Sharks Matter, when I was a graduate student. Like, that was intense. It turns out we later moved, I did my postdoc in the city where this kid and his family live, and they helped us get our amazing apartment. They put us in touch with a realtor who knew a guy, and these people have remained part of my life. But it was for everyone who was on that trip, they said it was their favorite trip because it was just so moving to see how much this kid and his family appreciated the chance to do something like this.
That definitely sounds very, very special and something that not a lot of people will get to duplicate. So our next question, you mentioned earlier that you don't have a lab set up yet, so it kind of plays into that. What is your dream job or dream location to work in?
My dream job would be, academia is the life for me, but I would like to be at some sort of public-facing, public-serving university where I can do policy-relevant research and university-level teaching while doing public science engagement on the side. So I don't want to be a policymaker. I don't want to be someone who all I do is talk about other people's science. But I want to be somewhere where I can do science that matters for policy solutions, and somewhere where this sort of public outreach stuff that I do is valued. And probably somewhere in the Southeast, somewhere warm and on the ocean. Southeast or Gulf.
If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Ooh, some of the more interesting questions in shark conservation biology at the moment are, I mentioned earlier when you asked why do sharks matter, that we know that the loss of top predators can destabilize ecosystems, but field experiments explicitly testing how are very, 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 very rare because they're so expensive and logistically complicated. So there's a lot of things where I would like to do experimental manipulation of removing certain parts of the food chain and seeing what happens. There's a lot of ways of doing that have been done on smaller scales. It hasn't really been done with a large ecosystem much. That would be a really, really interesting study.
And finally, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Sharks are not a threat to people. And in fact, we're better off with healthy shark populations off our coast than we are without them. And there are things you can do to help make sure that that's the case.
David, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all of your social media expertise and some of the stories you were able to share with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Nick. And again, if anyone wants to follow me, it's at Why Sharks Matter, and I'm always happy to answer any question anyone has about sharks.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. and don't forget to head over to our Patreon page and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 73rd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, sharks are not a threat to people.